From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Pete Stoughton.
Oh, good morning, Pete.
It's a great morning, and it's great to have you back.
Well, it's great to be back, and I have to say, you know, it was 90 degrees where I was on vacation, and I kept hearing news from home and a foot of snow and all of this, and I was kind of groaning and saying, oh, I don't want to go back. And then this morning, I went out for a walk as it was getting light, and the snow was all over, and the air was crisp, and luckily, I located a coat and a hat and everything, and I thought, this is beautiful. It's beautiful, and what a great place we live.
I just am glad that you didn't get pummeled by snowballs by the local kids, you know, just to bring you crashing back to the reality of soon to be winter, the impending winter.
We will see. Boy. Well, we've got a great show this morning. I'm really looking forward to this. We start off with New Yorker staff writer Khalifa Sané. Now, he joins us this morning to share his new history of popular music over the past 50 years, refracted through the big genres that have defined and dominated it. Okay, so what are the seven big genres? Rock, R&B, country, punk, hip-hop, dance music, and pop. Khalifa explores why music unites and moves us like nothing else.
And then, taking a shift, we will meet with local residents Anita and Craig Gordon. And they have a unique and unusual professional path, one of a wedding officiants. They'll share their stories of what led them towards uniting literally hundreds, if not thousands, of people in holy matrimony. Is it more often joyful or stressful? Can they spot a marriage that will last versus one that will falter before the honeymoon is over? And we will find out as we speak with them.
Now, David Letterman said this about our next guest, Khalifa Sané, that he has achieved the impossible by managing to unspool everything you need to know about 50 years of music. But more impressively, he makes you care about all of it, even the stuff that you don't care about. It's funny, it's personal, and as Letterman says, as a piece of writing, the book called Major Labels, A History of Popular Music in Seven Genres, borders on poetry. Now, music is not a top topic that we often speak about on The Mountain Life, but since music weaves together culture, memory, society, experience, and emotion like nothing else can, and we do talk about those topics on this show, we thought we'd invite Khalifa Sané, who is a New Yorker staff writer since 2008, and before that he spent 6 years as a pop music critic at the New York Times. He joins us to discuss why we love what we love, and why we so often hate what other people love in terms of music. Khalifa Sané, welcome to The Mountain Life. It's great to have you.
Thanks. So nice to be here.
Well, in thinking about this interview, I just have to start off. We'll get to the genres, but I've been, I'm going to admit this, a fan of Neil Diamond since I was probably 4 years old.
Yes. But,
I know.
No
Pete's,
shame.
Pete's looking at
great
me
singer.
Like...
Great singer.
Yeah. But I would say my kids have no idea who Neil Diamond is, and yet they know every single word, and then the added words to Sweet Caroline. And what wedding...
Yes, I'm sure they do.
What wedding happens without Sweet Caroline coming over? And I just, you know, wanted to ask you first about that. Like, how does that happen to a song and why?
I know it's not just weddings, it's British sporting events, right? They played Sweet Caroline at the boxing match last weekend. I mean, Sweet Caroline is everywhere, and it's a great example of how often the things that are supposed to be kind of like the most serious, and this is the immortal work of art from this period, often they get overtaken by things that were supposed to be kind of frivolous or supposed to be silly or that weren't taken that serious, right? You know, Britney Spears is a great example. Baby One More Time is one of the most immortal songs of the modern era, right? That song hits the radio and basically never leaves for decades. And that's one of the things that pop music can do, right? It can kind of creep up on you. It can worm into your brain until you're not even sure if you like it or not, but you know it by heart. And you know, the story of popular music is the story of moments like that, and also the story of the opposite, right? The story of people saying, no, I don't want to listen to that. No, I don't like that song that quote-unquote everyone else loves. And, you know, for most of us, that push and pull, you know, defines our life. Most of us have things that we like and things that we don't like, and especially for young people, certainly for me as a young person, that was the appeal of music. I fell in love with punk rock when I was 14 years old, and, you know, I was just totally obsessed. Like, I literally remember taking my Rolling Stones cassettes and, like, putting them aside and thinking, I'm never going to listen to the Rolling Stones again. I'm never listening to anything that's not punk rock. And, you know, that didn't turn out to be quite true. But that feeling of I want to define myself, I want to figure out who I am, that turned out to be something that I could never quite shake. I write in the book that punk rock represents the universal human desire to be a little less universal. And I think that many people have that expression, have that experience with music, not necessarily punk, but with some sort of music as a young person, and that feeling that music is something I can use to connect to people, but also to set myself apart from other people.
Oh, so true. And our choice of music tells us so much about who we are. And it often makes me feel like I'm a very boring person because I, you know, I'm not like this person that you described you were as a young person. So what was it about punk that attracted you? Is it the words? Is it the music? Is it the lyrics? Is it a mixture of those? Is it the culture or the counterculture? What is it?
By the time I discovered punk, you know, my parents are both from Africa. I moved to this country when I was 5. They lived a bunch of places. They were both academics. So punk was in no sense my birthright. It's not something I grew up with. And when I discovered it, it's 1990, and I'm living in suburban Connecticut. And, you know, the world of the Sex Pistols is a world away from anything I knew. So it wasn't that exactly. It was the shock, I think. And what that means is the idea that music could be different from other music. I think what that represented to me was the idea that you could make your own mind up about music, that you could have opinions about music, that, you know, music wasn't just like it came on in the car or it came on TV or with your friends and you said, yeah, yeah, yeah. Music was something that you could fight about, that you could have opinions about. And so I think, in retrospect, to me, part of the appeal of punk was that it kind of taught me something about thinking critically and about discernment and that you could have opinions about everything. You could figure out what you thought about the world. You didn't have to accept what someone else thought about the world. And that spirit of contentiousness and disputatiousness is one of the things that music can do and one of the ways that we can enjoy it, even as we all yearn for that thing that you described, maybe, of music as a source of comfort and something that can bring you together and just sounds good on an almost pre-linguistic level, like just somewhere deeply, it sounds good, it feels good. And, you know, most of us have that experience that you perhaps have when you're listening to Neil Diamond of like, yes, like this is right. This is what music is supposed to sound like. Everyone who doesn't love this is really missing out in some way. And sometimes we express that slightly less kindly, but that feeling that everyone else doesn't quite get what I get is one of the real pleasures that music can provide.
I'm so enthusiastic that we have this commonality that you and I were probably at CBGB's watching Social Distortion together and that we're kindred spirits in some way. So back in the 90s. So
I love Social Distortion. I don't know if I ever saw them live, but Mama's Little Monster I definitely had on a dubbed cassette somewhere.
Yeah. Well, and much of your book is about the history, kind of understanding where the music has come from and how it affects us. Music hasn't always been this autonomous process of self-exploration. talk a little bit about history and how that has changed for music to kind of embody that space.
Yeah, I wanted to say something about and to acknowledge the fact that in a sense this is a golden age for music, right? Other art forms exist, but we don't expect that people use theater to shape their identity in the sense of you go around asking high school kids like, who's your favorite playwright, right? It doesn't have the same identity building function that music does. And music won't always necessarily serve that role. It certainly didn't always serve that role. But certainly after the 1960s and the recognition of youth culture and the creation of this music industry that would cater to youth culture, music became an easy way to make some of those choices. And so, you know, my theory in the book is that a lot of us know or think we know what happened in the 60s, right? It's something about the Beatles and Motown, and maybe it has to do with the Vietnam War. And then starting in the 1970s, everything gets sort of complicated, sort of fragmented, sort of confusing. And, you know, part of the reason that happens is because these groups that we form, they splinter the way groups often do. And we have subgenres and sub-subgenres, right? It's not enough to like rock and roll. It's like maybe you like hard rock, or maybe you like heavy metal more than hard rock. Maybe it's thrash metal. Maybe it's death metal. Maybe it's black metal, right? You can go all the way to the extreme, even as other people are spending time listening to soft rock or singer-songwriters, right? They're listening to Paul Simon, or they're listening to the Indigo Girls, or all sorts of things that can represent a different way to be a rock artist. So that sense of fragmentation, again, is what provided a lot of the sense of fun that music provides. And it's funny, we often talk about it, especially these days in political terms, right, about America as a fragmented country, a place where people can't talk to each other, can't agree. And one of the nice things about music is, in the world of music, it's easier to see that fragmentation, but also to appreciate it. And my book, in a strange way, is a book about the upsides of fragmentation. What's good about the fact that music is divisive? What's the upside of divisiveness? What do we get when we have these little communities where people have kind of tunnel vision? And part of what I argue is that the diverse world of music that exists today wouldn't exist without that sense of fragmentation, without that kind of tunnel vision, without listeners and musicians who are so close-minded, so narrow-minded, so pig-headed, if you will, that they just want to focus on their thing. And through that, you know, you get people who spend their whole lives thinking about smooth R&B. You get people who learn the entire history of bluegrass. You get people who are deep into techno. And you get these really deep cultures from that kind of energy and concentration that you can only get when we divide. And so there are lots of reasons to lament the divisions in America, and this book tries to find some reasons to celebrate them.
You know, it's curious because you do, you know, clarify, we are a fragmented society in so many ways, but I'm curious, are we as fragmented in our musical appreciation? Are we as clear-cut with iTunes and music so accessible? I wonder, like, even my kids and other kids, it seems like they dip their toes in different genres all the time, and sometimes even their personification of how they dress can change. Like one week they're this, one week they're that. Are we noticing that as a trend, or is it really becoming more fragmented?
Well, certainly anyone who's my age or nearly so can remember the sense of commitment it used to require to buy an album, right? To spend, you only had
so much
money.
3 hours at the record store.
Yeah, and not only that, but part of what I realized was part of the thrill of buying an album was that you were kind of gambling. Like, you didn't know if it was going to be good. Sometimes you might never have heard any of it. You just heard it might be good, so you would buy it. Sometimes you heard a single on the radio, and you're hoping the rest of it would be as good as the single. And sometimes you'd take it home and be horribly disappointed, right? And just as in gambling, maybe losing was part of the thrill sometimes. And it's certainly true that you don't have to make that kind of commitment now. Traditionally, genres exist partly for the convenience of the music industry, right? Radio stations need some way to identify the listeners they're going after and telling listeners, we are your home for rock and roll. This is your place to hear country music. And similarly in record stores, right? It's helpful to have different sections where the music is divided. That way people can find what they're looking for, or they can find things they don't know they're looking for. And so there is this question of, in the era of streaming music, in the era of Apple Music and Spotify and all these services where you can kind of hopscotch among genres and listen to these playlists, like, does genre still matter? And what I discovered when I was going back through the past 50 years is that the current moment isn't actually as anomalous as it might seem. Throughout the history of popular music, there have been moments when it feels like everything's coming together, right? The 60s were one of those moments where, when people talked about rock and roll, when Time talked about the rock and roll revolution, they were talking about the Supremes as much as they were talking about the Rolling Stones. Then things go their separate way. Things come together again in the disco era, right? Where it seems like all music is going to become one music. We're all going to be on the dance floor, and the Bee Gees and the Rolling Stones and Diana Ross, and even Star Wars has a disco hit in the 1970s, right? And everything comes together, and what happens? You get backlash, you get fracture, you get people pushing apart. And so one way of thinking about the current era is that we're living through one of these coming together moments, right? We're living through a moment when there are artists like Post Malone and Lil Nas X and Billie Eilish, and they're kind of drawing from everything, and they're little bit of hip-hop and a little bit of pop, and you might even hear some country and some rock and roll, and in the streaming era we can all enjoy this stuff and come together. And if history is any guide, part of what's happening now is we're setting up the next backlash, the next group of artists that are going to be more polarizing than that are going to say, no, we don't want to be part of that Spotify mix and match world. We want to do our own thing. And if you're looking closely, you can see it even now, right? One of the big music stories of the year is this singer Morgan Wallen, this country singer who's one of the biggest and best acts in country music. And his music gets pulled off of country radio because a video emerges of him using the N-word during a night out with friends. Morgan Wallen is white. And so he becomes this act that's incredibly polarizing, right? You talk about everyone's listening to everything. Morgan Wallen is kind of the opposite of that, right? He has huge support even now, or especially now, within country music listeners, and people outside of that world might refuse to listen to him on principle. So he's an example of how music can be really polarizing and really divisive, even though if you take the time to listen to Morgan Wallen's music, you hear that he's borrowing from rock and roll, he's borrowing from many different kinds of country music, he's borrowing some of the rhythms and the beats and the production tools of hip-hop. So his music is a really hybrid form of music, even as his cultural identity is kind of pure and polarizing. And that speaks to the ways in which music, even now, can push and pull at the same time, pulling people in and pushing people out.
Well, that is amazing to think that we are coming together as a society through some of our music. And hopefully those are just some examples of small outliers. And you mentioned Post Malone. We have an affinity here because he has a residence here in Park City. So what's up with Post Malone?
I've been to his house there.
Oh, you need to stop by next time. We'll have you in studio.
I certainly will. I wrote a cover story on Post Malone for GQ Style magazine a few years ago. Yes, and Post Malone, you know, I talk about Post Malone, you know, as an example of someone who's borrowing from all sorts of stuff. And when he comes out, he comes out with White Iverson, and it seems fairly obvious that he's a hip-hop artist, and he's influenced by all this stuff that's going on in hip-hop, and like many white people in hip-hop, he's self-conscious about his whiteness, right? He understands that in some way that makes him an outsider to this music, but he still feels an affinity to it. And as he goes in his career, you know, he sort of evolves into something that's more like a singer-songwriter. He strums a guitar on stage sometimes, and he's drawing from all these different things. And so, yeah, he's a great example of how these boundaries sometimes get blurred. He's also a great example of how race is often salient in these discussions, right? You mentioned before that it's good to see that people are all coming together and audiences are mixing and matching. And yes, there is value to that. But a lot of artists have found, especially black artists have found over the years, that there is value to the idea of black music and to catering to black listeners. And a lot of musicians over the years have taken a lot of pride in that. One of the most bittersweet stories about genre in the book is the story of Whitney Houston, who comes out and has huge success out of the gate, and she does really well on pop radio, and this is kind of a surprise to her record label, and that kind of gets her cast as almost more of a pop singer than an R&B singer. I think it's Time magazine that called her the prom queen of soul. And there's this heartbreaking moment in, I think, 1989 at the Soul Train Awards where some people boo Whitney Houston when she's nominated for an R&B award, because the perception is that she's not really R&B. The perception is she's not a true R&B artist. She's kind of too pop. And this really affected her personally and professionally. She kind of redoubled her efforts to work with R&B producers and to get success on R&B radio stations. And so, yes, there's value to everyone coming together and music mixing and matching, but there's also value to these communities. It sometimes reminds me of politicians who feel like no matter what happens, they need to keep the base happy, right? And musicians, maybe they wouldn't talk in terms that are quite so crass, but just like, even more than politicians, musicians like being part of a community. And so as much as they might want that so-called crossover success, they often want to be considered part of the community that they call home.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Kelepha Sané. He's written a book, Major Labels, A History of Popular Music in Seven Genres. It's interesting, this conversation about black music and white music. And let's go a little bit into hip-hop. I feel like I learned about hip-hop from my kids and also from podcasts in which there was an exploration of why these lyrics, why did it sound like this? What was the struggle? What were they introducing? What was the story and the culture? And then I started to really enjoy hip hop music because it made you feel like you could identify with a culture. And how much of that, you know, how much are we doing that? Are we stepping outside our comfort zone and identifying with cultures that may not be our culture?
Well, that's certainly part of the excitement of music for me as a kid growing up, you know, falling in love with punk. It wasn't like, oh, these people are just like my friends. It was like, these people are maybe a little scary. I remember going to see the hardcore band Fugazi in Boston in, I guess it was 1991, and I saw skinheads in person for the first time. And, you know, I was kind of terrified. I was like, are they going to beat me up? And that sense of fear was also part of the thrill of that world. And so often part of the fun or the thrill of listening to music is that you get to enter into someone else's world for however long the song lasts or however long the album lasts. Hip hop, of course, is unusually good at creating this immersive sense that you're in someone else's world, partly because of rapping. It's more word, they use more words than singers do. And because they're rapping, it kind of sounds like they're talking. It raises a whole bunch of different questions, right? You hear someone talking to you, talking at you on a record, and you think, like, who are you? Like, what gives you the right to talk to me? And that's not a question that singers face. And I think that's why rappers are always saying their own name, right? The way a host at a party might, right? Even on Sugar Hill Gang's Rapper's Delight, I am Wonder Mike and I'd like to say hello, right? Uh-huh. That sense of like, come on in, get comfortable, because that is the sense that I'm going to talk about what's going on around me. And so hip-hop lyrics have tended to be less abstract than sung lyrics often have been, and they tend to be more specific, more detailed, sometimes more offensive. One of the fascinating things about hip-hop is it's been very popular, right, since its inception, but it's never quite been accepted. There's never been a moment when the cultural elite in America, when the politicians and the professors get together and say, wow, hip-hop is great. Those rappers are doing a great job. We love them, right? That's never happened. Even though, in retrospect, people are constantly going back, looking back at earlier forms of hip-hop and saying, hey, that is really great. And if you believe, as I believe, that hip-hop is maybe the greatest modern American art form, this makes a lot of sense. These records are incredible. I've always felt myself really lucky to be living at a time when this form of rhymed verse had a connection to all these neighborhoods that often are left out of other conversations, and is some of the most popular music on the planet. I've often felt just privileged to be alive at the same time that someone like Outkast is making records. But at the time, there's always pushback and there's always critique, and rappers themselves have tended to be both obsessed with the idea of respect and also wedded to things that are going to provoke outrage in people or offense in people. And that's been the twinned identity of hip-hop, is to provoke people and to delight them. And so there's always been criticism mixed in with the praise and sometimes drowning out the praise.
We've got to let you go here soon, but I wanted to ask you about you talk about the music everyone hates, but don't we have to hear the music first? That means somehow it gains popularity for us to then hate it. I mean, you would think the music we all hate, we haven't heard because it hasn't been popularized.
Yeah, that's a good way of thinking about it. Any music that you hear on the radio, someone loves it, and probably a lot of someone's. That said, for anyone who cares about music, often there is, you know, there are values you have, right? Even if it's within an artist, you like some songs they do more than others, some albums more than others, some artists more than others, some genres more than others. And so this book does also wrestle with that question of taste. What does it mean? Why do we choose what we choose? Is it a pure reflection of our background? Does it reflect our personality? Does it reflect the stories we tell about each other? And certainly anyone who's ever gotten together with friends to talk about music, you know, part of that discussion will be talking often with great enthusiasm and heat about things they hate, things they don't like. I can't stand that song. I can't believe anyone likes that artist. And I wanted this book to feel like that. I wanted it to feel like talking to someone who was going to tell you some stories about music. And often those stories about music can sort of resemble arguments, because often arguments are the process by which we discover who we are and what we love. And so this book is a book about that.
Hey, really quickly, with 15 seconds left, why do we remember all of the lyrics to American Pie? Or as you say, I am Wonder Mike and I'd like to say hello. You know, why do we never, ever forget those lyrics?
Yeah, certain things are extremely catchy, and American Pie turned out to be an early example of meta rock and roll, right? This tradition of singing rock and roll songs about rock and roll. And this, you know, this argues that this is a moment when the genre has become self-conscious. And as I argue in the book, rock and roll has basically been self-conscious ever since. The chief subject of rock and roll, it often seems, is rock and roll itself.
Kelefas Sané, such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for joining us on The Mountain Life. And do stop by the station next time you're visiting.
Thanks.
Post Malone.
Thanks, I would love to. This has been fun.
All right, take care.
Well, our next guests, we are so excited to bring on. Craig and Anita Gordon have the happiest clients of any professionals around. And it's not just because they are good and or great at their jobs. They are. But it's also because of what they do. They are professional wedding officiants. Utah Wedding Officiants.com is their business. They are husband and wife officiants with 17 years of experience. They help tie the knot for literally hundreds of couples each year. Anywhere, anytime, and for any gender. They join us now to discuss their business. Welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us. How are you guys doing today?
Great. It's better to have you both in studio with us. Beautiful people who have beautiful jobs. And, you know, many of us know Craig with the Utah Avalanche Center and how he's saving lives, but we're really excited to learn about this other aspect of their lives, the Gordons. And Anita, you are one of the premier wedding officiants in the state. And how did this journey start for you?
Officiant to the stars. You know, it actually started through Craig and I's wedding. We were married in 2001, and the search was on for an officiant. And I'm good at research, and I could not find an officiant anywhere in Salt Lake. I worked in a company of 200 young people who married you, a bishop, ooh, that won't work, who married you, you don't want who married us. And I could find no one in this state to marry us. In the meantime, my brother's a minister in Texas, and he and the family were coming up, but I just wanted him to sit and enjoy it. But then it became, yo, bro, guess what? You're doing the wedding. And I also knew at that time that my job was coming to an end in 1 year exactly. So what I discovered through my brother is that weddings do not have to be, dearly beloved, we're gathered here today. It was fun. It was happy. It was laughter-filled. It was love-filled. And I was like, you can do a wedding this way? I can do this. I got this. So I took a year and researched. And at the time, in 2001, there was only one wedding officiant on the internet for Salt Lake, and that was for cowboy weddings. That was it. So anyway, I put a website together, and on April the 1st of 2002, I threw it out there, and the rest is history. It just took off. And one of the reasons it took off, because there wasn't anyone out there, so every time I would go to a venue, they'd say, hey, can we put you on our list? Because we don't have an officiant. So sort of the right time, right place, saw the niche, jumped into it, and it's, I absolutely love it. Just fell in love with this. I mean, what's not to love?
Right. It's an extremely happy time of life for everyone, hopefully. And you get to be at the center officiating that whole process.
Yeah, it's always exciting. After we were trying to figure out the other day how many weddings I'd actually done, and it's 2,800 is what I've done in these years.
Wow. And yet a wedding is both the most stressful and the most joyful event of people's lives. Writing your own vows, one of the most difficult tasks. Craig, I know that you are never short on words. You've written a book. You're a very gregarious and social person.
Right on.
Do you help people write their vows, or how does that all work?
Yeah, kind of the structure of it is that Anita and I will meet with our couples. We'll get to know them, you know, kind of feel out their energy, their vibes, see where they're coming from, make that connection. And then we'll help kind of navigate them through the wedding process. And there's really a lot of structure to it, you know. So, I mean, some folks, you know, want a spiritual wedding. Others want something more traditional. But what we do, and maybe something in between, what we do is we help couples craft the structure of that wedding, help them craft their vows, get to know them, and then at the end of the day have a really solid deliverable that best reflects the love that they have for each other. Hopefully this great journey that they started, we guarantee that our marriages stick. We make love stick.
Guarantee.
We've got like a
warranty clause.
Yeah, right. Just signed right here. And so we individualize each of these ceremonies. And you know, not every single couple that we work with decides to write their own vows. A lot do, but it's sort of 50-50, you know. And like you say, Lynn, I mean, not everybody just wants to step up to a mic and just, you know, bare their souls to an audience, and there's significant other to be. And oftentimes couples just want to repeat after us. But then what we suggest is, hey, on your honeymoon, you're walking on a beach under the moonlight, you're cracking a bottle of Martinelli's or champagne or whatever it is, you know, a seltzer. Why don't you just take that moment, write a few thoughts and messages down, and then you can share that really sweet moment together. So that's kind of how we work. That's the framework. That's the vibe. And like I said, we have a really solid deliverable at the end of the day.
I have to ask a few of the questions that I'm sure people in the station have been talking about this morning. And in fact, Craig, you officiated at one of our colleagues' weddings.
I did. It was a beautiful, beautiful wedding. Yeah.
But we've asked, like, are you able to spot the marriage that's not going to work, that's going to end before the honeymoon is over? I have to ask that question.
You know, for me, just everybody seems happy that day. There's no like, I don't know about this one, you know. We talk about this. The thing that we have learned in this 20 years is there's somebody for everybody. Yeah. And it was just so really an eye-opener, because you just go, how did you find each other, you know? Because they're a perfect pair, but they wouldn't be perfect for many other people. So these two people found each other, and those are the ones I love to see.
That's a beautiful thing.
Well, tying with our previous interview, I'm also wondering, is there a song that you just dread hearing? Because you've had 2,800 weddings, and when the music starts, you just go, oh, I can't wait to that hot one stops. Or maybe perhaps a song that you just love hearing at every wedding.
You know, I really like them all. I like them upbeat, but I like it when couples have fun with it. I had a wedding one time when the groom walks in, it's the song that's playing is Another One Bites the Dust. And I love it when they take it and have fun with it, because really, guests want to be entertained. The worst thing in the world is a boring wedding. Mm. It's just miserable. So guests want to be entertained and laugh and have a good time, and that's what we try to bring to it. I tell people, if you're looking for something really serious and, you know, this isn't me, you've got the wrong person. So, because it's a day of joy. It should be filled with love and celebration and laughter and tears, but then some more laughter. Let's have a good time. These two people found each other in this big old world, and I just love to bring that to the service.
And speaking of two people who come together and bring joy to the world, the two of you bring a ton of joy to the world, and now 2,800 couples get to experience that joy to the world. How do you determine who's going to officiate one wedding versus the other? And I'm sure Craig is always like, I got it, I can do it. But you're the boss, Anita. So
we advertise that I'm the pretty one and he's the funny one. But then I back that up with, but I can be funny and he will never be pretty. So
and then I pick that up with, you'll never be an avalanche forecaster either.
Well, that's so true. That's
everything
true.
Overlaps pretty well.
You know, it's we ask the couples, which do you prefer? And sometimes I'll meet with a couple, and then they'll find out Craig's my husband, and they went, he does this too. And I said, well, yeah, you can have him if you want. No, that's okay. You know, we'll take you now.
Have you ever officiated together?
We haven't.
Oh. No, we've never done the tag team.
It might
kind
of take the spotlight off the couple if you did that.
Yeah.
Okay, how often do couples not cry at some point during the ceremony? I'm such a crier. I have never been to a wedding, even as a guest, where I'm not, you know, tears streaming down my cheeks.
Oh, I'd say 90% of the time, the bride or groom cries. And surprisingly, I think it's more the groom, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know,
for sure.
Like, I can take it when the bride cries, but when the groom starts crying, it's like, oh, don't do that to me, you know? Because that just touches my heart. It just tells you what a tender-hearted soul that person is. But we have tissues lined up in our book, and we just rip them out. Here, take this and repeat after me. And so
And how often do you cry?
Well, and that's the toughest thing, you know, especially when it's a couple where some big burly guy steps up, you know, and all of a sudden the tears start streaming down his face as he's reading his vows, and you realize just how touching this whole thing is. And I'm telling you, man, there is sometimes where you're just kind of fighting things back, you know, oftentimes though. And just like Anita says, I mean, the world loves to be entertained, you know, and I found that through avalanche education and forecasting and workshops, and it's no different in the wedding world. I mean, people do not want to come to something that is very stiff and rigid. They also don't want to look around and say, hey, what just happened here? You know, like my drunk uncle just showed up and performed some sort of whacked out thing. They want something that has got a beautiful flow and a tenor to it. I mean, just like reading a book or listening to a song, you know, it's not a static medium. And man, there are sometimes, like I said, a big guy will get up and start reading those vows, and it's like, wow, this is just coming from a deep part of this person's heart. And it's super touching, and it's really a beautiful experience to share.
So Craig shared with me, Anita, that you were officiating 150 weddings this year. And again, we did say no math on the show today, but I am going to have to bust this out. We are using some numbers. There's only 52 weeks in a year, so you're doing 2 to 3 weddings, either a weekend or a week. How do you do that?
You know, easily in the summer, easily, I do a minimum of 5 a week. You know, there might be a weekday. There's always a Friday night, a Saturday morning, a Saturday night. Could be Sunday morning or Sunday evening. The last 2 weeks of this June, I did weddings every single day in the last 2 weeks of June, and sometimes 2 weddings a day, and then jumping in the car to go to Moab to do a wedding, and then jumping in the car to get back to do a wedding.
Wow. So
there was a lot of buildup after COVID.
There was a ton of buildup. Yeah, after that 2 weeks, it was like, I can do anything now. Because the rest of the summer was, you know, 5 or 6 a week. That was nothing. But that 2 weeks was like, ooh, this is tough.
And will that continue through the winter? Will Craig pull up on a snowmobile for a wedding and ride out of
it? He has
done those. Yeah, I've done those up on ridgelines in the Uintas along Jupiter Peak here in conjunction with some of my friends and colleagues at local ski patrols. And that's a blast. To be out on the snow and doing a wedding on skis is a pretty special thing. And you know that you've always got a really deep connection with that couple.
We've all been to weddings where the ceremony sort of drones on and on. Even if it's not boring, there's a sort of a sweet spot in terms of how much time. What is that sweet spot?
17 minutes.
17 exactly.
To be exact.
My photographers know, well, one, I always tell them what's going to happen, if anything different, so that they're prepared for it. And they'll say, 17 minutes. I go, 17 minutes. They know what it is. And we're just short attention span Americans, and it can be a very hot day or a very cold day. I just did one on, was it cold on Sunday? Is that when the weather turned? Mm-hmm. Anyway, a Saturday night. Oh, it turned. It was cold. And unbeknownst to the couple, I'd already removed half of the ceremony. But then they asked for me, and I went in to talk to them. They said, listen, we need you to take out half of the ceremony. I said, it's already done. Mm-hmm. You know, it's done. It's what you have to do. You can't have your guests sitting out there in the cold. And it's not pleasant. It just isn't. Let's get this done. Let's get you married. Let's go have a party, you know. So,
right.
Yeah, 17 minutes is about it. But we'll do them 1 minute. We'll do them 40 minutes. It's whatever our couple wants. But we explain to people, you're going to lose them after this time. It doesn't matter how good of a speaker I am. Where's that bar? You know, they're looking around at that point.
Exactly. Okay, I heard last week about someone who rappelled into their, you know, place that they were going to get married. What are the craziest kinds of things that you see like that? And obviously that's not something that you choose, but you may, you know, help mm-hmm. people say, well, you know, you might want to row across in a boat or show mm-hmm. up on a white horse, but what if the horse bucks you off?
You might want to think about some of these variables, right?
Well, I think one of my crazier ones was getting picked up down at Lake Powell in a boat and then driven out to where all these houseboats were and to do the wedding there. And then they put me back in the boat and drove me back to the marina. And I think for Craig, his craziest was being delivered by a helicopter.
Sure, we did that.
Oh,
yeah.
Tell us about that, Craig.
That was actually pretty rad. So picked up out of Little Cottonwood Canyon. Small wedding party, flew back into Mary Ellen, had a very sweet, very remote, very secluded wedding just in a big meadow off of a ridge. Really pretty special, you know. Right. And I would say, you know, to go further with that, Lynn, I think kind of that notion of the crazy entries is, you know, you scratch your head when you see some of these ideas, but there's lots of variables that are introduced, even in a more traditional wedding, like when people choose to bring their fur kids as a ring bearer, you know. And I mean, I can remember, this big poodle that was going to be the ring bearer, you know, who everything was really good in the rehearsal, and man, when it was showtime, this doggy got stage fright. I mean, it jetted out of the venue, and it's like, oh yeah, sometimes there's no controlling that. But you know, I will tell you, I had a really amazing wedding last year up in Little Cottonwood where the bride and groom, they were surrogate parents for a golden eagle that had been injured, and they helped to rehab it, and it was gonna be brought back to a native area that it could thrive, and that was Upper Little Cottonwood Canyon. And so after the vows and after the couple kissed, we released this golden eagle. And man, talking about, and I mean, it gives me chills just talking about it. So spiritual, so beautiful, so heavy. And as the eagle was released, it started going down canyon, it dipped a wing, it flew over us, so it gave us a flyby, and it took off. And it was like, wow. That's probably something we'll never do again. Yes. So, you know, along with all of the mantra and the vibe of just a beautiful day, you really do get to experience some once-in-a-lifetime unique opportunities.
And I'm just envisioning, Craig, you coming in on that helicopter, hanging from the, the bottom, that eagle in the background, and you know, the shirt unbuttoned just a bit,
or a tank top.
A tank top. you let the hair loose.
You must have seen a video of this.
It is viral on the website. So, for two amazing people like yourself who spend so much time helping others start their marriages. You've been married for 25 years?
We've been together 26, married for 20.
Okay.
Yeah, not a bad run.
Yeah. Hopefully it keeps going. Anita, thank you for your patience with Craig.
And really, I mean, you know, Anita's destined for sainthood.
She is. Everybody's going to see you at the local stores and just applaud you as they walk now. What have you learned about your relationship and having all these experiences with other relationships?
There's a lot of words, and I even use them like if I have friends maybe going through a difficult time. And I just, you know, use some of the words that I actually use in a ceremony. But on a funny note, one time we were having a disagreement, and Craig used some of those words on me, and I went, "Don't you use my words. You know, you just back off of that. I wrote that. You can't use that against me." You know, we truly are each other's best friends. We went on one date, and we've simply never been apart. It was just meant to be, and that's how it is. But however, I was a snowboarder, he was a skier, he hated snowboarders, I hit the snowboard, I got the date, then everything was cool. And he doesn't hate snowboarders anymore either.
And I would say we need to kind of wrap some guardrails around that word, hate.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's soften that. Thanks for that, Pete.
Well, talking about wedding vows and these things that we write at this stage in our life when maybe, you know, we're full of, you know, everything's rainbows and unicorns. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as we all know, marriage is no easy ride. It's a lot of work. Do we forget to go back to those vows? Do they just sort of dissipate in the midair after the wedding, do you think?
You know, I think it's good to have some of those reminders or mementos around, whether that is a visual thing, a physical thing, some sort of, you know, spiritual cue that you look at, and, you know, maybe during a difficult time you see a picture or you see a memento and it's like, oh yeah, that's right, there was that spark and that's still there, you know, and it kind of brings a little, you know, a little twinkle to your eye, and it's like, man, the little stuff is just the little stuff, right? And just like you say, Lynn and Pete, you guys know, I mean, this is a journey like any other relationship, like any other partnership, whether it's work or family or marriage, it takes a lot of work, you know, and you get out what you put into it. So, I think just being able to have some of those cues and you step back for a moment, you said, yeah, this is why we're here. That little stuff that's just static right now.
You know? And we say, you know, if it was easy, we wouldn't have divorces. It's just not easy. Yeah, you know, 24/7, and you grow and you change, and you hope you change together. But yeah, it's not easy.
One last question about the weather, because you brought that up on Saturday night or whatever it was. A lot of, you know, weddings, June is the big wedding month, right? But there are afternoon thunderstorms in June. What's the craziest story about weather that you've ever encountered?
It was actually one of my favorite weddings. It was held at the canyons up at a Red Pine Lodge, so you had to take the gondola. And the day before, it was 98 degrees. It was beautiful. The next day, it's 53 degrees. It's raining. It's cold. It's miserable. Myself and all the other wedding vendors and the wedding party was already at the top. But then lightning hit and thunder, which means they have to hold all the guests for 30 minutes. They can't come up. But the good news was they were plowing them with champagne. By the time the guests got up to that wedding, it was probably one of the best weddings ever. I mean, they were happy. I'd gotten the couple over, you know, like, hey, at the end of the day, you're going to get married. I know it wasn't your vision, but let's have a good time. We're going to make this work. But I'll tell you, I will never forget it because it was a miserable day. Miserable.
Mm. Well, it's so great to have you guys on, and it's exciting that you are kicking off a lot of people's new lives together. I've already booked Craig August 3rd, 2023, for a renewal with my wife. And if she's listening right now, I'm probably going to get a ping for our 20th anniversary.
Yeah, yeah.
So you do renewals, I am assuming.
Oh,
I should
ask. Of course, friends and family discount.
And it's actually a favorite thing to do.
Oh,
yeah,
this
couple
that's
has
a
stuck
blast.
It out, and at the end of the day, they're saying we'll still take each other in a heartbeat.
That's right. I hope she says that.
Yeah.
So.
Indeed. So Utah WeddingOfficiants.com. You can catch us at one stop shop for all things wedding.
That's great.
Thank you so much.
Craig and Anita Gordon.
Oh, thanks for having us. Our
Absolutely.
Pleasure. What a blast.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life. If you missed part of the show or want to share it, we podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows. Wherever you find your podcast, you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name. So look for KPCW The Mountain Life and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.